Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and co-parents of all ages, this podcast is for you. Introducing in the center ring, the amicable divorce expert, Judith Weigel.
When I was with the circus, our chief financial officer, Harry Hammond, traveled with the show in the ticket wagon. Now, I don't mean Harry Hamlin, the actor married to Lisa Rinna. I actually mean Harry Hammond, the Clyde Beatty Cole Brothers Circus chief financial officer. And Harry was so good with money. So all of the marketing directors and performers would always go to him and ask for his advice on money because we got paid in unusual ways. We got paid salary, and then we had per diem, and then we could trade out for tickets. Fast forward to today in family law, I am speaking to a most unusual person in the financial arena who I wanted to come on this show because I think Jonathan Satofsky is going to advance your thinking if you're preparing for a divorce, on the edge of why you want, whether you want to get a divorce or not, or in the throes of divorce. And as we all know, part of divorce is creating a divorce settlement, and part of the settlement is financial. So first of all, Jonathan, I am thrilled to have you on the program. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I have to tell people what you do. So Jonathan does a few unusual things. He wears a few different hats. One of the hats is he's a chief behavioral coach, and the behavior is over how money is used. He's also a financial therapist because money makes us crazy, so we have to be calmed down a lot of times. And he's a financial mediator, and this really interested me because I've never heard anybody say this. Maybe we can start with that. Talk to me about being a financial mediator.
So couples come into a relationship with some biases, conscious and unconscious biases and patterns that have been developed, oddly, from 0 to 8 years of age, based on what they witnessed in their family, in their community, in their socioeconomic situation. And it framed like a computer. It was a computer program that set a foundation for how they see their relationship with money forever. And so often, you know, sometimes couples get together, there's a yin and yang, you know, opposites attract. So in relationships, it's not uncommon to have one person be a nervous Nelly or a depression era, you know, fearful about money and markets. And then there could be the other side that's a risk taker and a gunslinger and a go-go, you know, stock market investor fearlessly. And the mediation is finding the middle ground in order for both to feel comfortable and healthy and psychologically safe in the relationship to co-create a monetary future.
Oh my God, that was really well said. So as a mediator myself, when would you come into the discussion on the settlement?
So there's a part of the experience we were talking about, the emotions of divorce, and it's not easy, but if you lay out the facts on a balance sheet and a cash flow statement, and the parties trust you as an independent third party, an objective independent third party, to be able to show a combined balance sheet and separate balance sheets and separate cash flow statements of what things can look like pre and post divorce, you can have a constructive conversation. When that happens is really subject to the willingness of both parties, how contentious the divorce is, and if a divorce attorney and or mediator like yourself brings someone like me into the room instead of a forensic accountant attacking people on both sides from a financial planning standpoint to look at things as how can both parties have a viable future so they can calm their nerves and proceed with calm confidence to find an equitable middle ground.
I love this. And I never thought about it. I mean, I know when the forensics come in, what that looks like, and each party, when there's enough wealth on the table, each party will have their own forensic. And so then the forensics start talking to one another, supported by the parties. When did you start doing this, though, this financial mediation?
Well, it's unfortunately a byproduct of the fact that I had parents that have been divorced. My father's been divorced twice. My soon-to-be ex-wife's parents were divorced. My father has been divorced twice. So I think it's just a byproduct of having witnessed dozens of clients go through the experience of trying to sit with each party. We actually have been working with couples, and then oddly, and I think, I don't know whether this is unique, but it feels like it must be unique. In over a dozen cases of the last 25 years, when couples have split, because we've been able to advise both parties, we continue as a firm to advise both parties independently, which is, I think, quite unusual. It's unusual because generally someone will be like, oh, that's your guy, I'm going to go somewhere else. So I think it's a testament to my team to be able to find the middle ground and to provide psychological safety and comfort to be able to help people confidently forge ahead and know that we have their back and aren't taking one side's part, you know, part over the other, you know.
And so I was going to ask you that. What happens when a family, a couple that you've been working with just in terms of handling their money and growing their wealth portfolio, when they have to get divorced, you really know where everything is. You know, you don't need to come up to speed, right? So therefore, yes, they do have a level of confidence in you, and I can expect that that would work. All right, now, when people hire services, it's generally geographically sensible. They'll hire somebody within their own area. Well, the pandemic has been the game changer of all time. And people are now working across state lines. And I'd like to tell everybody listening that you're actually in Italy today. And you said you were picking up clients as we were talking before we started this episode, the taping.
It wasn't intentional.
It wasn't intentional. But so before the pandemic, did you have clients in other states? Now, also, I need to tell everybody, Jonathan lives in New York State. But did you have clients in other states prior to the pandemic?
Prior to the pandemic, we have clients all around the world, from Indonesia to the UK to, we have clients all around the world that we've worked with, California, you know, across the 50 states, because the business is all word of mouth. It's been organic. If you help one person, let's say I was doing a great job for your family, you would say, you know, my clients have become my sales force. They become raving fans and they refer me to their mother, brother, sister, father, and they generally work across those family lines or across the globe. I just had a client unfortunately pass away in Israel, and we're settling in a state, and one of the family members lives in San Francisco, another family member lives in New York, you know. So we're dealing with global families, and the pandemic, as you pointed out, this is an experiment for me. I've been in Italy quasi on a vacation, but I've also visiting clients and being referred to some other potential clients. It was casual and it turned into, oh, I need someone like you, you know? So what's interesting is I was experimenting with the time zone. Cause to your point, you can Zoom from anywhere. You have a phone, you can talk to people from anywhere in the world. So why not try to design a life where you can work anywhere in the world? I just have to be cognizant of the time zone. So I have a team that's in Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey, New York, Florida, Montreal. I mean, I've employees that work everywhere. Why can't I be anywhere? As long as I'm engaged and reachable, there shouldn't be an issue.
Well, unlike law, you don't, money doesn't change from state to state, I would assume. And unless you're a tax accountant, and it varies a little bit state to state, at least on the statewide level, I guess that is why you can work anywhere, because money is money, right?
Absolutely. There's definitely tax jurisdiction issues across the globe, and that's something to be mindful of. And we'll work with, if we don't have the expertise, we'll either research it or work with their professionals or find someone locally to handle international tax issues or local tax issues. But by and large, you're right. You know, money is a psychological relationship that people have. And to be able to be a financial coach, behavioral coach, financial therapist, whatever you want to call it, to help people with their relationship with money, to empower them to reduce stress and to enjoy their lives, to be able to turn off their phone and be present for life. That's a gift. And if I can accomplish that for a handful of people, then I think we've done something magical.
Okay, now, you hit a nail on the head when you said that people's relationship to money starts within the first 8 years of their life. Whether they're cognizant of it or not, we pick up the behavior of our parents. And that's for anything. That's for relationship building. But that's for food, you know, the way we eat, the way we exercise, take care of ourselves. Yes, children can all adapt behavior from their parents slightly differently, but we do learn from our parents. Okay. I had somebody on a few months ago, and we talked about financial infidelity. I found this to be such a fascinating term. And for me, it was a learning lesson. I remember in my family, my dad was real conservative. He, back in the 50s, because I'm ancient, back in the 50s, and in Pittsburgh, where I grew up, $40,000 was quite a lot of money to earn. You know, and he had a supervisory position in with Gulf Oil. My mother, on the other hand, they were both Depression era babies. My mother also grew up not as poor as my dad, but her relationship to money was scarce, the idea of scarcity. My aunt, her sister, wouldn't throw saran wrap away. She washed the saran that was on another piece of food to use it again, and the aluminum foil. I mean, these people really worked with money well and saved money, but my mother felt financial freedom, I believe, when my dad was making more than her parents made. And so I remember my dad and mom having conversations about, Julie, you're spending too much money. Let me give you, she was a stay-at-home mom, let me give you the budget for the week. Let me give you what you can spend, not only on groceries, but I'll take you shopping, but other things, and please live within your means. Very difficult for my mother to do that. Guess who I picked up after? You got it, Mom. Can you talk a little bit about this concept of financial infidelity, which a therapist defined as, just like sexual infidelity, spending money without your partner knowing it?
So as you pointed out, it's people have addictions to drugs, alcohol, shopping, spending. You know, it's yes, there are some money scripts that have been planted in our minds, and to change habits takes a tremendous amount of self-awareness of the impact of those habits cumulatively over time. So it's a process. It's not something, you know, people don't quit smoking, you know, oh, I saw, you know, smoking's bad for me, I should quit. It's not that easy. It takes time. As the saying goes, do you know how to eat an elephant? Inch by inch is a cinch. Yard by yard
right.
is hard.
That's right.
So we just have to get into patterns about something simple like paying yourself first. If you've set aside 10% for your future self and you have discretionary excess that you want to buy a pair of shoes or you want to splurge on a handbag, go ahead, as long as you paid yourself first ahead of time.
Well, what were your habits? Were you always phenomenal about money, or was this a learned behavior that you like so much that you went into this profession?
That's a very fascinating, that's quite a question because I never really thought about it. I had witnessed money scripts from my parents and my grandparents. There was a bit of scarcity. I mean, I remember my grandfather would, every bill, he would, you know, take out the calculator and, you know, check the bill and add up the tip. I mean, I was just like horrified. I thought it was like, ugh. So I loathed money. I loathed the idea that money seemed like such a taboo topic. It seemed to be a really stressful topic in life. And they don't teach it to you in high school and college. So I figured I would do this for 2 years to learn about money so that I can help my mother become, this is a technical term, un-F-withable.
Or in other words, financially independent.
Yeah, I saw the vulnerability that divorce had caused her to be a little needy and maybe compromised in decision-making for that need for money or need for security and stability. And I didn't like that. So I got into the money field because I wanted to help her become un-F-withable. And I have wanted to use that knowledge to help others get freedom and realize real quickly, I wasn't thinking about myself. You were asking about me, but I wasn't really thinking about myself. I was thinking, if I can help other people with their money and foster better relationships with money and help them pursue their life goals. Many people wanted to get out of a job. You know, retirement is like dying from whatever. Ugh, I hate what I do. I got to get out of this. That's kind of crazy if you think about it. If you're doing something you love, you don't want to get out of it. It's not about the money. It's about the love of it. But it's really hard because many people do something for financial security. So my relationship with money has evolved, and I think everyone's relationship with money evolves. When I was young, I was working so hard to make it that I wanted to enjoy it like many other people. I wanted to save some, and I wanted to enjoy it and find the right equilibrium and balance, hoping someday if I kept helping people that I would have money to have my own financial freedom. So it's been a tug of war, particularly in a relationship, based on unconscious scripts that my wife of 25 years had with her father and me trying to be accommodative to find a healthy relationship, not knowing these money scripts were create a lot of tension. So my running joke is there's two great stresses in life, sex and money. I can't help you with the sex, but I can help you with the money. And if the money's better, I think there's a positive correlation to better sex. So my money script continues to evolve in that regard and trying to find a way to be able to use money. Money is a form of energy for me. And if I use money to be able to, I could use money as a form of energy where I can spend time with a degree of freedom to spend time with who I want, when I want, where I want. And you made a point of not all business is good business. If someone calls me that wants help with financial advice, to do it on to be financially secure enough to do it on a terms where it works for me not bending over in a pretzel trying to accommodate someone in a way that makes me uncomfortable or makes me stressed out.
Right. Well, Jonathan, in terms of these money scripts, I know that when people get married, and I've been married and, by the way, amicably divorced, I always say this and I am proud of that, what should the dialogue be? other than do you want to have children, do you not want to have children, that takes place. But so often people never really talk about their ideas of money, spending money, and they get into these marriages and find out, oh my God, the credit card debt my spouse has is unbelievable. Here, let me pay it off for him or her. But that never really does it because him or her just goes back into credit card debt, you know, once they're off the hook with what they have currently. So what should these discussions be like prior to people even getting married?
It's an excellent question. I think the values of what's important to unpack it, you know, people go to marriage counseling, you know, financial planning and financial therapy is a form of marriage counseling because you can establish the kind of life that you want to design. Where do you want to live? How do you want to educate your children? Where would you like to retire? What kind of traveling, what kind of lifestyle would you like to have? And how do you prioritize these things so that when you're taking the dreams and then you're looking at the analysis or the analytics of the situation, you can then get to reality and say, okay, we now may need to make trade-off decisions. Now we need to prioritize. You've laid out 10 dreamy goals, but let's really pick two or three that are the most important. Let's start knocking them off and start designing a life and then recalibrate year to year. It's like seeing a chiropractor. You got to keep adjusting and recalibrating because people's vision of life changes even so much as this COVID situation where family and friends die and all of a sudden you have a wake up. You're like, you know what? I don't want to live like this anymore. I've been, like you said, a depression era person and I haven't been spending, I haven't been doing anything. I haven't even lived. I want to live a little. I want to do things that I've never done before. I want to travel. I want to experiment with starting a new business. Whatever it is that someone's dreams are that they've been withholding, to fearlessly pursue a future that's unapologetic in a way that can redefine their money scripts.
Great, but let's go back to, we're planning on getting married. We sit down with a wealth management person to look at how to take the monies we each have in our accounts and do something with them now as a couple. So you're in the meeting and you're hearing each other be very different, express themselves quite differently about money. And maybe you really didn't know how much or how little the other person had saved or how much and how little debt they were in. So you're in the meeting and all of a sudden you're seeing this person differently than you had anticipated they might be. Do you consider this an important pause for thought before they even get married?
It's an excellent question. I would venture to guess in my quarter of a century of being involved in this, I think one couple has come before they've got married. People probably should have that conversation beforehand, but generally people don't come to a financial planner, wealth management firm, advisor pre-marriage because they're going in with the same emotional, like just love and we'll figure it out and ignorance that they decouple in some ways on the same emotional toxicity of, I got to get away from this person. I don't want to, you know. So yes, conscious coupling and conscious decoupling is what, you know, the amicable nature of what you're talking about. That's an ideal. It's like, I forgive the silly analogy, but many years ago, there was an ad campaign that the government kicked off about how healthy vegetables were in society that people should eat. And meanwhile, once that ad campaign raised awareness, consumption went down. So people might know what a good thing to do is. It's not necessarily that they're going to do it.
They're actually going to do it. Okay, now, when I started working in divorce, which was 9 years ago, I really thought, like probably most people, the biggest reason for a divorce is infidelity, sexual infidelity. I didn't realize that financial incompatibility was the A number one reason why people get divorced. And so the longer I work in this business, the more I really like to talk about the unsexy conversation of money before you get married, because it's going to be the bullet that really kills the marriage. Now, let me give you an example, and I'm sure you're not unfamiliar with this.
Well, before you go, before you give the example, I want to say one thing. You're what? Spot on. And I think the root of it, if you get to the root of it, you need each person to have a degree of psychological safety. And what does that mean, psychological safety? You need the person, both people, to feel comfortable and their itch is felt. If one person's a gambler, give them a side account to gamble, as long as it's not going to blow up the core of their finances. If one person's a miser and needs to save a lot of money, let them save a lot of money and hold up excessive amount of cash, as long as it's not going to deter their ability to be able to achieve their long-term goals. So let people scratch their itch and give them psychological safety. Sorry, I needed to say that.
No, that was really good. I like that. I really did like, because you're not going to completely change anybody, right?
No, you got to give them their sandbox.
Really, really good advice. I'm going to give you an example that I have experienced way too many times, so therefore it must be happening in society a lot, and I'm sure you've experienced it too. And so a little guidance and advice. When people get divorced, and if it's for financial reasons, which then ruins the intimacy, it's pervasive in terms of the destruction of the entire relationship. So regardless of what state you're in and what law governs asset and debt division, there is a portion of the filing where you have to fill out disclosure forms. One is about assets and debts. One is about income and expenses. In the asset and debt form, there will be a page that's completely addresses debt. And I have seen enough times one spouse just about pass out when they look at the debt on the other spouse's page, having no clue that they were in such serious debt. Some debt, yes, that's why we're here, but not to the point where they have to catch their breath. And to the point where, if there are children, and if spousal support is going to be requested, because maybe it's a stay-at-home mom who needs a little time to get on her feet and go out to work, there's not even money for that, because the minimum payments on the 30 credit cards eats up everything. There's no other money to live. I hesitate when I suggest bankruptcy as a consideration. What do you do in a situation like that? Is bankruptcy the only option?
The answer is it depends. You know, really the situation is always depending on 1,000 other factors that you have to know: the earning capacity of one or the other spouse, you know, the other inherited potential to inherit assets, or, the ability to restructure their balance sheet. Maybe the debt is high, but maybe they can refinance the debt at lower interest rates. You know, there's things that can be done from a financial standpoint that can get them onto more solid ground and solid footing. Maybe they can sell off assets and pay down the debt to get to an equilibrium level. You know, there's things.
Jonathan, this generally happens when there are no significant assets and there's no real estate.
Yeah.
That's when this generally happens. And I remember asking a client a few years ago if bankruptcy was even a consideration, because I, in my easy mathematical formulation, said, I don't know where you're going to go with this. There's nowhere to go. You hit a brick wall. You have children.
That could be a reasonable option for sure.
Yeah. It's, you know, there's a lot of pride that's wrapped up into filing bankruptcy on one hand with some people, and then with other people, they filed more than one bankruptcy, as many as the law would allow. So, yes, that's a tragic moment when one spouse becomes clearly aware of the reality of the debt, and they had no idea. So let's go to financial independence. I love that you talked about this. And I am sure, Jonathan, because you have a fabulous life, that you don't watch The Real Housewives of New York City. But I do. So in The Real Housewives of New York City on Bravo, Ramona Singer, who has always lived on Park Avenue in her married life, now divorced, they had one child. And she said, making money is my aphrodisiac, but I sincerely believe that everybody should work. That's her opinion. She said, when you agree to be a stay-at-home mom, even if your spouse can truly afford to carry the family, you have given up all your power and independence. Can you please speak to that?
I think there's some truth there. I think that the degree of self-worth and pride of raising children is, I think, amazing. Yet, if both parents are all in on raising children and having their own identity and their own careers, there's a sustainability there where that you get both intellectually engaged and connected, and you build a somewhat of an independent life. You know, I think that in relationships, the strongest relationships are where that each person feels whole and comfortable on their own. And then when you're together, you can collaborate and co-create without that codependency. And I think that what is described in that situation, when one spouse gives up total control and power, it becomes a very vulnerable codependent situation that leads to unhidden toxicity, and that's dangerous for both parties, unintentionally.
There's a little piece of what you said that I want to go back to that was wonderful, and that is when both parents are all in on careers and raising the family. So you see models where two people, both parents work, but one parent really comes home and then cooks, cleans, handles the kids, does homework. It becomes uneven at home. And what you said I liked in that, have two careers so you can grow independently and as a couple, so you can have financial freedom. But when it comes to raising children, you have to be all in as a couple as well and divide those duties.
Ideally, you know, but to your point, when you have that split of responsibilities, what I have witnessed in my own situation as well as others is the spouse that's home says, this is my kingdom. Your voice is not welcome here. You have your kingdom and I have my kingdom. And therefore, you have a philosophical divide on how children are raised, on the values, the philosophy, the ideas. And I think that both parties, you know, you share the genetic DNA that you're passing on to a child, but both parties have experiences in life and in the world that can bring to bear for the development of a child in a more holistic way, because they're seeing the world through a different lens. And to shut out one or the other voice in work or in child rearing, it's a further separation and divide of this is my camp, that's your camp, without a Venn diagram of some overlap and respect and admiration for the ability to be able to grow common threads together.
Right. But do you think that when this is my kingdom comes up, that person doesn't have a full-time career, right? That's the person who runs the house. Is that how you're looking at it?
Yeah. And the, yeah.
But what you said I thought was great a couple minutes ago, and that is both people can have their own careers and keep growing intellectually, but they both have to then participate in the raising of the children and the maintaining of the household. That's what you said, right?
I think it would be, I mean, I might be, maybe I'm dreaming about Pleasantville, but I think it would be wonderful in order to help people be more empathetic to each other. Because even if one is the primary caregiver at home and the other is the primary worker, if the other person's working some and the other person's caregiving some, you can be more empathetic and compassionate to the challenges that the other person is dealing with. And therefore, your communication can be healthier. And you can build a more healthy debate and when you get into conflict.
True.
Because it's not you're shutting one party out.
Right.
You're respecting and valuing the other person's voice. When someone's voice is not valued, you gave the point that divorce happens because of money. It's not just money. It's when people don't feel valued and heard and understood. And if someone doesn't feel like their voice matters, then you're like, what am I sacrificing for someone when your voice doesn't matter?
Well, you know, you find that in a traditional situation where one person spends more time at home or has more of the domestic duties, obviously makes less money, and the other person makes more money and has less domestic duties. Now you come to divorce, and the person who had more domestic management wants to hold the kids out, doesn't want to share visitation. But I've made all these decisions. I know how the school goes. I know the activities. There's no reason why that should change. But it has to change. It simply has to change because kids need both parents. That seems to be forgotten when the challenge of getting divorced is upon us. Do you not think?
Unfortunately, it's a control issue. Power and control end up causing people to do things that they use what they perceive to be their greatest assets. And it adds to the emotional trauma that is both experienced not just between spouses, but as you said, filters down to children and their relationships for a lifetime. It's unfortunate.
And then the cycles repeat themselves. Again, we learned so much of what we, who we are in the first 8 years of our life. You opened with that earlier. All pretty amazing stuff. So, as a financial therapist, a financial coach, a financial mediator, when you're in a situation where you're meeting people who are new to you, you haven't been their wealth management person at the point of divorce, so you're now meeting them, you're called into a situation where you can help distribute this wealth. And so you have the spouse who makes more money saying, well, I don't believe in spousal maintenance. She or he just simply needs to get a job right now. And I don't understand why I have to divide things. Forget about the law says it. This is the personal philosophy and thinking of a human being sitting at a table where settlement has to take place. How do you respond to those very well-known comments that come out of some people?
Certainly it's difficult. I think listening with empathy and compassion to the pain that each party is confronted with in these situations is of the utmost importance. That being said, there is laws for a reason. And the laws will lay out what is fair and equitable. You're in a community property state, and there are certain laws of how these things happen there. In New York, it's more of an equitable distribution state. And the each county has a different view of what equitable distribution means, for example. So you're trying to make sure that both parties are in a healthy spot going forward. Your example, if I bleed the example of this person should get a job with the example of someone in massive debt, I can understand why there's a tremendous amount of anger and resentment that the life, something called lifestyle drift has come up.
Say that again, and something like what?
There's a concept called lifestyle drift, where that a couple, you know, you get married, you don't have any money, and you start, you know, as time progresses, because you're aging and culturally and societally, the people around you start spending more and more money, you start spending more and more money without any conscious awareness of the impact of this. If you have not sat with a financial planner year after year after year to recalibrate, what happens is I say, well, oh, your balance sheet has gone up fivefold, but your spending has gone up tenfold, so you're actually not any better off than where you were 10 years ago. You know, this is a disaster. So it's not just the expansion of the balance sheet. It's keeping, if your balance sheet is going up faster than your expenses, that's a good thing. But if your expenses are going up faster than your balance sheet, you're not on a trajectory toward any chance of sustainability. And that's where that story of, yes, the spouse should go work comes in understandably. It's understandable why that comment happens. And it's unfortunate that there couldn't have been a healthier rhetoric and conversation along the way, that it doesn't have to get to an explosive situation before we get there. So you just have to separate the parties and try to get to some degree of reality, and hopefully either a mediator or unfortunately, if it has to go to a judge, the judge will see through the situation and say, you know what, this party was a spendthrift, and you know, it's not realistic to bankrupt one spouse to support a lifestyle that's completely out of control because of financial ignorance.
Okay, so another example, this is interesting. Decent amount of money on the table, not seven figures, but very high six figures. So that's good, even in California, that's pretty good. And the higher wage earner did not know what the lower wage earner was spending. Just, you know, that it's the way you organize your family. One person goes to work, they put some trust into the other spouse who may be working and earning a decent living, just not as much as the primary. And so activities, expenses are brought into the portfolio of spending that are seriously high and actually drive the couple to divorce. Now you have a situation where, and I don't know how this works in the equitable distribution of assets, which I kind of want to ask about in a minute, but in the community property state, like California and some others, you divide equally what's on the table, you know, anything purchased or acquired from date of marriage to date of separation with monies that we made on our jobs is community property. That's the umbrella concept of it all. But now you have activities that are so unbelievably expensive, maybe private school, because we're the world of private schools in Los Angeles, and there are one or two that are actually $4,000 a month for one child. The average is $2,000 a month for one child. $4,000 is pretty extraordinary. So you have a private school situation, and then an additional activity that is $10,000 to $15,000 a month. And that activity can only exist because of the higher wage earner. But the lower wage earner who organized the activity is the one who pulled the resources from the community money to establish and sustain this activity. That is a very difficult situation to deal with, because if you have children and the activities are for your children, certainly private school is for your children, now your child's life has to dramatically change. And that ruins the child's relationship with the parents, or at least the parent who had been providing for these extraordinary expenses. As a financial therapist and mediator, where do you go with this?
In a dream world, this is why it would be ideal. I remember, two ways to look at it. One, it would be ideal for people, as you suggested, to start building a relationship with some type of financial coach that they trust early. It's hard because I remember riding the E and F train from Kew Gardens, Queens to New York City. And I was reading an article about when people become successful in the financial advisory and coaching field, they don't have time and energy to help the people that need the help the most. And I was sad about that. And I was thinking, that's never going to be me. I'm going to help everybody. I can help everyone on this train with something. I don't know what I can help them with, but I'll find a way to help, you know? And the reality of life is time becomes constrained. So I, as a firm, what we've been trying to do is trying to hire younger advisors and coach and develop a team of people so that we can help subsequent generations as a quasi, like, it's not pro bono because we get paid, but it's pro bono in the sense that they're not profitable relationships early. But if someone's willing to be able to retain a financial advisor, coach, therapist early in those relationships as they're working through this stuff, they can mitigate some of these challenges later. When someone, it's sort of like when I first started, I remember 60% of people came to me at 65 to 70 years old. They're like, okay, great. I live in New York City. I got a $2 million home and I don't have much assets and I want to retire. What do I do? You're like, well, you should have come to me 25 years ago, but you know, you got to deal with what you have to deal with. And in those situations, they've left themselves they've cornered themselves to very few options. And then they become a forced seller of their home and say, well, you have to sell the home in order to support yourself because there's no other place to get the money. So you're painting a scenario where someone has already let their lifestyle drift to an unsustainable situation. And by the way, you're talking about unsustainable post-divorce. In some cases, it's unsustainable even if they didn't get divorced.
Right.
You know, I mean, I remember talking to a guy that was a bond trader and he made $150,000 base and 1 year he made a $2 million bonus. Well, 1 year they made a $2 million bonus. All of a sudden they elevated their lifestyle to $2 million. Well, he wasn't making $2 million every year. The next year he went back down to, you know, the base and a very small bonus. And they were like, well, what do we do now? I'm like, you shouldn't have let your lifestyle raise to a level where you knew the income wasn't sustainable. To think that income was going to sustain in perpetuity is naive. And you didn't accumulate assets to support it or to replace it. So the math doesn't work. And that also happens frequently with a lot of clients in LA and in the entertainment business because they're trying to keep up with the Joneses. It's unfortunate. It's sad.
Oh, so, I have to tell you, sorry about this, but of the high-end entertainment people that I have either filed for or mediated for, one of the hardest things is when you are at the top of your game as a producer, maybe you're a studio head or one of the people running studios, and now you're not, you don't change your lifestyle. You don't stop driving the Bentley or the Rolls. You don't stop going to Cannes. And you may have no money. You may have to borrow just to keep going to Cannes and driving these cars and living where you live. But they can't. Well, they can if they want. They can. I mean, but they emotionally can't.
Yeah. Well, it's like playing the lottery. I mean, I think I know this is not a popular character for the entertainment field, but like, you know, the beauty of Warren Buffett's ideology is about expectation management. If your overhead is very low and you live like the millionaire next door where you keep your overhead low, you know, you can't, you give yourself a greater margin of safety to be able to handle the volatility in income and life and markets going up and down. And if you're on the edge of the cliff, what happens when something goes wrong? I mean, it's not super fun to point out blind spots and to talk to people about what can go wrong. What's funny in the financial coaching business is the conversation is always challenging. When markets are down, people are afraid and don't want to spend and invest when it's actually the best time to spend and invest.
Isn't that the truth?
And when markets are up, people aren't building a cushion for a rainy day and taking, you know, the foot off the pedal and just carving, you know, things out for, you know, the dry season. So it's always the tension of trying to, this is the story about the king who was looking for the greatest wisdom in the world, and everybody came back and one person brought gold, one person brought women, one person brought, you know, whatever, all this stuff. And one person brought him a box with a ring. And he said, "What's this?" And he said, "Read the inscription." And on the inscription, it says, "This too shall pass." So he would wear it. And on a good day, he wouldn't let himself get too high. And on a bad day, he wouldn't let himself get too low. Realize that you got to find an equilibrium that's sustainable to minimize stress and to live comfortably in your own skin rather than your example of the Bentley borrower that's going to con, that's putting on a show and having a heart attack and his insides are rotting on the inside because he doesn't know how he's going to feed himself that night. You know, it's right. There's a lot of people that aren't comfortable and it's just not a healthy way to live. So
I know money is so tough. And I mean, in my lifetime, I've seen several stock market crashes. And it's just such a shame how that keeps leveling people. But going back to divorce, and you're sitting at the settlement table where you have to discuss the money and figure out who gets what and, you know, if there's going to be any support, what that's going to be. Using your observation that we develop our relationship to money and spending in the very early stages of our life. My thinking is, even though it's hard because we're upset, we're getting divorced, this is very uncomfortable, we're going to be living on a little less, whatever the settlement's going to be, we're going to be living on less. Two households live differently than one household with all the money coming in. But I'm thinking in a divorce situation, try and be understanding of your spouse that maybe has overspent the money for the family. Try and be understanding if they came from poverty. Try and be understanding if they come from fear that they will not always have money. You know, people fear being homeless. Well, maybe just in LA, but people fear being, no, it's not true. People actually feel being homeless. So what do you think about just that sensitivity to the other spouse while you're working out the deal points?
It's coming from a wide gap in knowledge and understanding. Insofar as a relationship with money, you can have compassion, yet you have to have a degree of humility of not thinking that there's an unlimited ATM that can pay for everything in perpetuity. I mean, it's tragic to say, but I heard in one conversation, okay, so this is the amount of income. And the spouse wants, in this example, 90 cents of the dollar, 75 cents of the dollar. So, well, wait a second. the person has to pay taxes, so they're actually only going to net 50 cents. You're wanting to pay more than they earn. How are they going to do that? And there's cases that because of either naivety or greed, you know, the attorney and the other, you know, the unsophisticated spouse will say, oh, he can just borrow money. So that means that the person working 24/7 should go into debt and bankrupt themselves to be able to pay out
a surviving spouse. Well, you know, funny enough.
I mean, it's better off being dead, you know?
I know. No, people actually do say that. People do ask for well more than half of what's even available to divide. And I guess I still am not able to wrap my head around that ask as I sit at my own mediation table thinking, okay, well, thank God we have the law. So that's our go-to position is the law. But what's happening in the justification of the spouse asking for more than half? Where is that coming from? I don't know where that comes from. Does it come from fear that they won't have enough to live on? Does it come from anger? I'm going to make you pay if you're the one that wants the divorce and has another relationship. Where does that come from that one person, this is the lifestyle I had with you, so I just want to keep living the lifestyle. And that's not realistic. Nobody lets that happen. Pardon me?
And you've hit it on the head. Entitlement, greed, fear, you know.
Yeah.
The attorney stoking it is like, oh, let's bury this guy. You know, whatever. Anger, you know, I mean, there's just a lot of things that contribute to it. And it's very unfortunate. And you mentioned earlier that divorce is sometimes more dramatic than death. You know, when someone passes away in the Jewish religion, you have 8 days of Shiva. You know, you mourn the death for 8 days. In a divorce, I think the mourning can happen for some people between a year to 5 years to really let the emotional weight of that experience. Or forever, yeah.
It is true.
Yeah, or forever.
Yeah. You know, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, I think she was a Swedish psychologist. She was the one that presented the 5 stages of grief when talking about death. I think her book on death and dying was where she presented those. But in divorce, there's actually 7 stages of grief. There's 2 more stages. It is that devastating because even though it's the death of a marriage, the 2 people in the marriage are still living and so you have to deal with each other. So there's more grief. There's a lot more grief going around. Do you have, as we end this segment, any words of advice for the divorcing couple? How they should look at the discussion surrounding the division of whatever wealth, assets, and debts they have, just for the sake of their sanity, along with the sake of their children, if they have children. Any words of wisdom?
I really think that you have to understand the parties that you have helping you. Everyone is going to chime in your ear of what you should or shouldn't do. Parents, friends, divorce attorneys, mediator, forensic accountant, you know, everyone's going to chime in your ear. You have to find a middle place, a middle ground of calm logic. And this is the antithesis of what divorce is. It's not logical. Emotions, high emotions lead to irrational thinking. So,
okay, that's very good. Hold on. This is good. High emotions lead to irrational thinking.
Like a seesaw. You know, it's like I heard a hostage negotiation conversation. If you're at super high emotions, all rational thinking is out the window. So the first thing to do in hostage negotiation is to de-escalate the emotions. So if there's any way to de-escalate the emotions in a divorcing situation, to have a logical conversation, I'm pretty sure most couples, if they can get to that calm state, if they were together a year, 5 years, 10 years, 20, 30 years, whatever it is, there's a degree of compassion that you want the other person to be happy and healthy going forward. You don't want the person buried. that you'd want to find an equal ground, that you would say, just hear me and understand me. I want to, I'd pay you 75 cents in the dollar if I am not going to have a heart attack and be dead tomorrow. You know, I mean, like, come on, let's get to an equal ground that we both can move forward in a healthy way with our lives. That's fair and reasonable for everybody. Let's work with, and in a dream world, this whole concept of collaborative divorce is really, it's maybe idyllic, but I think it makes sense. You get the attorney in a room, you get a forensic accountant in the room, you get a therapist in the marriage therapist in the room, and you get a financial planner or, you know, a certified divorce financial analyst in the room, and you have to, the parties have to trust the people in the room, but all those people in the room with separate rooms that you can knock things out, you can treat it like a hostage situation, de-escalate, and have, if they're trusted people in the room, have these trusted people working for the best interest for finding an amicable divorce, which is what you brilliantly do and have devoted your time to trying to lead to a healthy post-decoupling.
You know, to work in the field of divorce, the only way to work for me is amicable. When there's domestic violence, when there's anything other than the potential to have a conversation, I don't touch it. I just don't want to be there. It's too hard on me, and I think you really need other levels of professional in your life. It is possible, given the right circumstances, for people to have an amicable divorce, but given the right circumstances. And both people have to want it. They may not know how to go about it originally or at the beginning, but if they both come in with the intention that let's take care of each other, we know we have issues driving us apart, but we know we have to deal with each other, let's try and do the best for each other possible. And I do love with what you said about, well, you know, the person, you know, that's the higher net worth person wanting to be compassionate, but the other person has to be reasonable at the same time to allow the compassion to show what it looks like. So what does that look like financially, my compassion? So that they have to have the credit or there has to be trust.
There has to be some trust because the attorneys are going, right, to stoke the flame of saying, oh, they're screwing you, you know, blah, 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 whatever. You know, like he's hiding money or like they make up all sorts of fantastical stories that
incentivize
the lawyers to keep things going in a contentious way because that's their bread and butter. That's how they get paid.
Well, let me tell you, I have been very, very fortunate in knowing some phenomenal attorneys who absolutely don't want to do that, that really want to nail the divorce settlement as soon as possible, just for the health and welfare of everybody. So I just want to say out there, in any profession, you have some that are great and want to do the best, and you have others that can take advantage of the situation. So let's just say that there are good attorneys, and then, you know, you have to be careful of those who are just litigious by nature, love the fight themselves.
Yeah.
That's what you need to be careful of.
But your point, that's wise. But the other thing that you pointed out is it's healthy to have it amicable and end sooner, not just for the couple that have to potentially communicate in the future, but for the benefit of the children.
Absolutely.
And for the children's well-being.
Absolutely.
And ultimately, if you have grandchildren, you're going to be in each other's lives for 50, 70 years. You know, I mean, there's no reason for toxicity if you can avoid it or minimize it. It's every day, wake up anew and say, you know what, let me start today and find a way to find a common thread and common ground.
And that's what we have to do in life in general. I mean, in any relationship. So,
no,
Jonathan, so this was a great hour to spend with you. Thank you so very much. How do people get in touch with you if they want to follow up on your exceptional services?
You're very sweet. They can, I'm on a lot of social media channels, but we have a website, which is my last name, Satovsky.com, S-A-T-O-V-S-K-Y.com. And we have an office on 37th and Madison in New York City. It's 212-584-1900. And we have an exceptional team of people that handle legals, attorneys, people that look at the tax angle, people look at the insurance angle, people look at the investment angle. And we coordinate with outside professionals in order to, you know, try to compassionately collaborate to enable someone to live a rich life, pre, post-divorce, and even healthy coupling. I think that good financial counseling can keep people together in a healthier way and have better sex.
And what better note to end on for this episode? Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us. And to all of you, thank you as always for joining us. I appreciate each and every one of you. If you are not already subscribing, please do so. Please send the word out to your friends. And as always, have an amicable day.
That's our show for today. Thank you for joining us. Be good to yourselves, be kind to your spouse, and cherish your children above all else.